Recording live from the Hoban Law Group here in Denver, Colorado, I'm your host, Eric Singular. We're sitting alongside president and founder of the Hoban Law Group, Bob Hoban. Today on the Hoban Minute, we're talking about cannabis consumer archetypes and the role of women in the cannabis space. And Bob and I are joined by founder of Lady Jane Branding, Jennifer Wetzel. Jennifer, thank you for being here with us this afternoon.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Well, let's start by talking about Lady Jane Branding and the work that you do to help brands find their voice, find their identity in the cannabis space, which is a very competitive space. Some would even go as far as to say saturated.
Yes. Well, I have, as founder of Lady Jane Branding, what I focus on is helping entrepreneurs and startups build their brand identity. And the way that I've done that is using archetypes. And archetypes are a shortcut to help entrepreneurs develop their brand identity. And I've developed 16 of these archetypes with a multiple choice quiz to help those entrepreneurs identify which archetype is closest to them. And then they use the universal characteristics of those archetypes, their values, their personality, their tone of voice, to develop a very strong brand identity and strategy. And what archetypes are they are universal characters that exist in our collective unconscious. And so we understand intuitively what archetypes are. So when brands use them to build their identity, it helps consumers understand their brand quickly and make a deep emotional connection. So I found that shortcut really helps brands understand how to build a strong identity, but also how to maintain consistency in their branding, which is really critical in this market that's so competitive.
You know, when you think about brands in the cannabis space, you think about some of the early movers, and then there's been such an influx of different things. I guess I'd just ask you, you know, bluntly, this broad question. Do brands work in cannabis? And I think I know the answer, but I'd like to really just drill down into it a little bit. When you look at the different product lines that are available, when you look at, we've got flowers, right? Flowers, sometimes they're branded by virtue of the farm that they've come from. Some states require prepackaged flower, so therefore it's easier to brand flower. When you look at oils and edibles, it seems like edibles have broken through the most as it relates to branding, but you're the expert here. Tell me, do brands work in cannabis, given some of those dynamics and the differentiated product lines?
I absolutely believe they do. Brands are very important in creating a sense of trust between consumers and brands. And so when you're defining your brand identity and you're building your brand strategy, you want to communicate that you are that you're able to be trusted with your consumers. And, you know, building that really strong strategy and identity allows you to have that deep connection with consumers. And then it is a competitive differentiator for you. So, you know, the market where I live in Maine. And early on in this market where we had only medical caregivers that were not able to have retail stores, and they didn't even have packaging or brands for the beginning part of this market. And it was very difficult for these caregivers to differentiate their products. And so now in this market where we have retail stores and packaged brands, edibles and flower, now is how these brands are able to connect to the core customer that they're able to, you know, have that connection with. So, you know, I think that in building that trust with consumers, you know, that's the critical piece of branding.
No, that's an excellent point. And branding goes beyond, recognizing the logo, and like you said, it becomes that connection, that verifiability, if you will. A lot of folks, when they think about brands in the cannabis space, they think about celebrity brands. And my observation is that celebrity brands have not particularly gone well. There's a couple exceptions to that rule, whether it's the Snoop Dogg Leafs products or the Willie's Reserve products, some of that more notable products. There's certainly several Marley-type brand products. There's several lifestyle brands. And then when you throw CBD into the mix from non-psychoactive hemp, there's a number of other brands that sort of cross lines. Can you comment on the celebrity element of branding and just your perspective on what's worked, what hasn't, and you know whether that should be something that that companies, investors should be looking towards as they develop products to put into the cannabis regulated marketplace?
Yep. So I think that when it comes to celebrity brands, you know, what that gives the brand is that halo of familiarity with that celebrity. So that celebrity has already built their own brand identity, and you're leveraging that and borrowing that halo to get your product in the market and to show people what you stand for. So it is a valid way to get market exposure and to get that connection with consumers. Now, what I've done with my archetypes is I'm giving brands 16 different directions to go with the brand identity. And one of them is a rock star. You know, so to me, that's where those celebrity brands live, in that rock star archetype. But it's a big market, and we need more than just celebrity brands, and we need more than stoner brands, and we need more than doctor brands. And that's what these other archetypes provide for brands, is to give them different directions they can go with an identity so that they don't have to just use celebrities to get their message across or to make that connection. You know, they could be healer brands, activist brands, you know, like the Last Prisoner Project. They could be eternal child brands, you know, of talking about fun and enjoyment. They could be magician brands. There's all kinds of different directions to go to build that connection with consumers without having to use celebrities for that.
You make a good point, and you make several good points. And when you think about the size of this market, talk about some of the challenges in branding when you've got an intrastate marijuana industry. So I can't brand a particular product, package it, and then ship that product across the country. But there are workarounds to that. And there are examples of brands that have taken hold outside of a singular jurisdiction. Can you talk a little bit about the strategy there and what goes into that process, considering the tight regulations that govern our industry?
Sure. I mean, there's always the ability to license your brand in a new market. To bring your brand, your packaging, your messaging, and align with a local grower, a local business, to get your foot in the door in a new market. And when you have a brand that is successful in one market, taking it to another is a really good way to start seeding your sales for when you can actually ship products in between states. You know, but utilizing local growers is a way to get your brand name in front of new geographies.
And aligning with people that will produce quality products that fill that pipeline. Of course, you know, when we started to, almost 10 years ago now, when we started to work with different brands that started in Colorado and said, well, let's take that brand to state X or state Y, people would look at us and go, how's that possible? You can't do that because this is regulated in Colorado. But the notion was, to your point, it was, is this a trustworthy product that I can rely on to be consistent in quality? And can I take that concept through licensing or otherwise and bring that into other states? And of course, now we see the proliferation of that. But the idea at the beginning was a head scratcher for many.
Right. Yeah, that was it.
Well, and Jennifer, talk for a moment, if you will. We've talked a lot about the brand side of things, but consumer insight and consumer data seems few and far between, just given how nascent this industry is. What have you seen as far as what consumers are drawn toward as far as those archetypes are concerned, or if there is one that is more advantageous than another, in your opinion?
Well, interestingly, you mentioned data, and with this multiple choice quiz that I have for my archetypes, I have over 1,500 brands who have taken this quiz, and I have over 3,000 consumers who have taken a consumer personality quiz. So I can look at the distribution of archetypes among those consumers and brands, and I can see that there are there's a proliferation of scientist brands and doctor brands out there in the market. And when you look at consumers, they are more likely to be explorers. Well, there's lots of different consumers out there in terms of how they fall with the archetypes. But I've been able to build consumer personas for each of those different archetypes, demographics, psychographics, and the type of products that they enjoy. And with the Women in Cannabis study, I've been able to gather some very exciting data. I've had over 950 women take a 90-question survey in three countries. And that data, interestingly, besides what I have on equity and on women's experiences working in the cannabis industry, I also have gathered some data on the type of products that they use, the cannabis products that they use, why they use them, when they use them. So it's providing some really fascinating data, not just in their use, in cannabis use, but segmenting them by archetype and by personality. So we're able to see what matters to them, what are their values, you know, how do they define success? So it's really going to be helpful in terms of figuring out how to sell to heavy cannabis users. The women in my study, 68% of them use cannabis daily. So they are heavy users and early adopters. And these women are also, about half of this study population are business owners. So we also have B2B information on how to sell to female business owners in the cannabis space. So there's a lot of data that we've been gathering.
I'm so glad you brought up the study. I'd love to dig into that even more. So you said the survey primarily was for women who are working in the cannabis space. If you could share some learnings that you've seen, what are the challenges? Where are barriers being broken? Tell us what this study has revealed for you. What surprised you in this study?
Well, the study talks of it looks at women's experiences moving into the cannabis industry and their experiences within. So some of the barriers to entry that women are facing is, you know, lack of access to funding and resources. But the number one is not being taken seriously. The sacrifices that women have to make to work in the cannabis industry, money, savings, time with friends and family, time for themselves, their health, their sanity, sometimes their children or their freedom. Women who work in the cannabis industry deal with sexism and bias. 70% of them have been sexually harassed at some point in their career. And only 12% of them feel that the cannabis industry is equitable for women. But the thing that surprised me and delighted me the most is that 87% of these women consider themselves successful. And we asked them how they define success for themselves. And the majority of women talk about helping others, helping their clients, helping their customers. They talk about providing for their families. They talk about friends and happiness and personal growth and stability. But what they don't talk about is profitability and shareholder value. You know, so that we've got these women who are in this industry, women who are business owners looking for capital. And then when the capital comes, with that comes a different definition of success, you know, not what women want for their businesses necessarily, not all of them. So there's a little bit of a disconnect, because with that money comes expectations of profitability and shareholder value, rather than what my favorite definition out of all the women was: everyone around me eats too. And to me, that really summed up how women in this industry want it to go, like how they define success for themselves. And I think that's beautiful. And I love that that came out of the study, despite the fact that women they deal with a lot of struggles to work in this industry. And you know, some of the questions that I wrote, I have the same wording as the McKinsey and Lean In study, so that I had some comparative measures of equity, and we're far behind some other industries. So we have a really long way to go.
Now, to your point, it tends to be a male-dominated society, but even more challenging, perhaps, is a young male society. And what I mean by that is, you know, there sometimes when you have folks that are driven in a particular way, but coupled with inexperience in business, it leads to a lot more challenging environment, not just for women, but everybody that operate in it. But if you follow many of the successful companies in the space, and increasingly in the CBD space, it's women led, female led companies that are in fact making a lot of strides. They're creating companies that have the values you describe. They're able to impact the market, connect with consumers and customers more, not to the expense of profit necessarily, because that's not, you don't have to forsake one to get the other,
right.
but at the expense of going out and putting those values on the line. I think of some, you know, very successful women that serve as CEOs and leaders throughout the industry, and some of the organizations that have come and gone, unfortunately, that support women in this space. You know, thinking about sort of the rise of Women Grow, and not that it's fallen, but it's certainly a different organization than it was 2 or 3 years ago, for a variety of reasons, and then so many other events. It's a remarkable space. And to your point, while it's challenging to get in, it sure seems, based on the objective data, that the companies that have put the right female in the right position have succeeded at far greater rates than other companies that have either ignored women or have just been by design driven by, you know, male dominated interest.
And the data would show that as well. Actually, I just read McKinsey's latest study, and they are tracking companies over time to see how successful they are based on the mix of their leadership teams and how they're moving on equity. And the companies that did the best job in moving the measures of equity also did the best job on their bottom line. So it is, we're gathering the data. Lots of people are gathering the data to demonstrate that, I think that women need a chance. You know, more of us need to be running businesses and promoted to the highest levels to see how we can do things.
Well, and the value of this study is unquestionable. I want to raise one point, which is, we saw recently, as the new coronavirus bill has been introduced in the House, top Democratic leaders who want to put some money toward funding studies to see what the inclusion is of women and people of color in the cannabis industry. And I bring this up because last week, or the week before, Mitch McConnell got on the floor and just slammed this provision in the bill, saying that it was a waste of money and that cannabis was referenced too many times, and specifically called out this study. But I pair that against the fact that obviously leaders at high levels of government care about these studies. That's why the language was there in the first place. I guess what I would ask you is, what would you say to Mitch McConnell to convince him of the importance of this? And isn't it, a good sign in your eyes that this language is included and that there is attention being paid to this at the level of the federal government?
Yeah, I think it's critical. You know, all we had up until now are anecdotes about women's experiences working in the industry, and we've now turned those anecdotes into data and knowledge and wisdom. And the fact that the government is looking for this data in order to, you know, help this industry progress, I think is a really great sign, because, you know, it's not just anecdotes, it's science. So, well, hopefully they'll appreciate the science of it. But I think that, you know, moving this industry forward with this data is really critical.
It absolutely is, Jennifer, and both the work that you're doing with Lady Jane Branding is showing that, and the work that you're doing with this study, both incredibly, incredibly valuable things that we can't wait to see the more progress that you make and to have you on again in the near future to see how things shake out here in the next few months.
Before we let you go, I just wanted to get your take on a notion that we've seen out there, and this goes to your branding expertise and experience. We've seen a lot of private equity funds and lots of investors look at the cannabis space and say the way to succeed is to aggregate or create a collection of brands, so to speak. Can you give me your perspective on that, just generally speaking? Because as I've seen brands, to your point, in local or regional markets, it's that trust with the celebrity-driven items. It's trust on perhaps a larger scale. And, you know, it's hard to make that impact without the availability of advertising on a large scale, although still, to your point before, impactful and necessary. What do you make of collection of brands as an investment strategy? Because I hear it all too often. We've seen the Canadian companies invest in collection of brands previously as it related to cannabis products. We see the same thing happening on the CBD side. What do you make of that business or investment strategy, aggregating brands?
What I think is that, you know, what they're trying to do is appeal to as many different types of consumers as possible. You know, if you're doing branding right, you have a very well-defined audience, and it's limited. You can't market to everyone. But in order to increase sales in any given area, if you want to bring more consumers into the market, you're going to have to diversify the types of brands that you have that are focused on a specific audience, and then you can sell to a lot more people. So, you know, it makes sense from a business strategy to increase your target audience, not by saying I'm going to sell to everyone, but by having a brand that is specific to different audiences.
Sure. Well, that is something that we see prevalent and increasingly discussed amongst groups that come to this space that think they might know about some outside strategies that may or may not have worked well in the space, but you've definitely provided some insight there. And again, thank you for that. And it has been a pleasure talking to you, and we look to see how this evolves. And thanks for all of your efforts as it relates to the industry and your support of these initiatives that put women out in front, which ultimately leads to a stronger industry overall and just better run companies.
Thank you so much. And thank you for being allies and for having me on your show. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Jennifer. We'll talk soon. Thank you for listening to this episode of the Hoban Minute. If you have any ideas for episode topics or guests, we would like to hear from you. Reach out to us at media@hoban.law and stay tuned for more on the Hoban Minute.